Bob Dylan's backing band for almost 20 years now. Since recording Wall of Fire, Pete has recorded two more albums, Repeat Offender 2011 and the most recent album called Lion. These days, Pete has been keeping himself busy in his studio, writing, recording, and producing with a Toronto musician named Danny Nash. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Hi, Mary. Sorry, I was having some technical difficulties, so I kind of missed like the whole preamble because I started my car and now I'm driving and I missed all that. But I tuned back in right when you threw it to me, so hi.
Okay. So, Pete, before we get to start talking about everything, why don't we start the show off with a song from your 2004 album, Party of One, which is around the time that I met you. So let's play In My Den, and then we'll come back and talk about what you're up to these days, as well as some other stories about the music that you've made and experiences that you've had over the past couple of years, okay?
I love it. Yeah.
Great.
I could reach and pull you out from this den you dug in me. You curled up now.
Thank you. That was In My Den off the album Party of One. Tonight, I'm joined by Peter Elkiss. You're listening to a show called Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. So, Peter, thanks for joining. And what are you up to right now?
I'm driving around Toronto, around St. Clair and Caledonia, which is where I live. And kind of cruising aimlessly, which is what I like to do. And I'm chatting with friends.
Awesome. So Pete, so we just heard a song off of 2004's Party of One. I guess the next album in the sequence of your recent albums was 2007's Wall of Fire. So Wall of Fire was produced by Charlie Sexton, most famously known for being in Bob Dylan's backing band for almost 20 years, and I guess more recently now also being an actor, right? so how did you... So how did you end up working with him, and what was that experience like?
I wish I could say it was like we met over like a trash can campfire in an alleyway somewhere in Austin one night, but it was really more of like managers speaking to managers. I had a manager named Larry Wanagas, who was Katie Lang's manager for many years and has worked with the Trues. And Larry decided we needed somebody who could really add some flavor to the record. And he knew Charlie's production manager. So they just connected, and Charlie liked what he heard from my demos. And then he called me one day, and I was pretty blown away to chat with him. And he seemed to just kind of be down for the adventure. And he came to Toronto, and we recorded at a studio called Monumental, which is actually really close to where I live right now, which is funny because it really kind of smelled bad around there back in those days because it was beside the meatpacking plant. That studio since moved and is now the kind of internationally famous Studio Revolution Recording. It's the same people. But we did a lot of, we worked there for about a month, and then I went down to Austin and finished it with Charlie and his right-hand man, Kyle, down in Austin. And it was like, I mean, you remember the time, like it was pretty magic, you know, and it could have been a disaster because Charlie didn't know me or the guys in the band, like from Adam. And I think he was pleasantly surprised that we could play. And it just like, we gelled with him really quickly, and he wound up playing instruments on every song. And we did it all live off the floor, and he set up kind of like a trap drum kit beside Gavin's drum kit. And you can hear that, all that stuff on the record. Like if you listen closely, it's just the two of those guys like really tightly playing together and creating an amazing bed for the rest of us. And I don't know what to say. Like that was one of the best things that's ever happened to me, musically speaking. And for everything else that, you know, like all the kind of highs and lows that come with kind of raising the stakes with your music career, like we had to pony up dough, you know, to make that happen with him. Like the label kind of Maple Music, like they sort of had to raise the stakes a little bit so that we could get a named producer. And really, like, you know, when you do things like that, oftentimes it can have like an adverse effect because it's expected to do well. Like, you know, you're expected to sell records. And we didn't necessarily sell as many as they would have liked. So it's funny, like it didn't go as well in terms of like sales, but the album creatively was like one of the greatest things I've ever done, for sure.
Well, and there was a real sense of camaraderie, I recall. So at the time, Gavin, your drummer, was one of my roommates. And, you know, sometimes if you're working in a studio with musicians at the end of the day, and if, you know, if you're kind of working together and you don't know each other before, you kind of go your separate ways at the end of the day. And I remember I used to meet you guys at the end of every session night over at Ted's. And you just all seem to really get along. And I think that, you know, the camaraderie and creativity really comes through in that album. It's a beautiful album.
Thank you. Yeah, it's funny. I think some of the sort of like maybe sensitive or I would say possibly maudlin kind of lyrics kind of belie the actual really good times that were happening. Like, I think to me, the song that captures the vibe that was happening with the dudes is the song Something Beaming. I think that's got kind of what was actually happening. with everybody and the joy that everybody was feeling, because the tunes, I think, maybe are a little bit breakup-y and, you know, kind of down in terms of the emotion. But it was a super fun time. And, like, yeah, after every night we would go to Ted's and we would get a shot and a Creemore beer, and then we started singing this really stupid melody, just being hyperactive, getting into a cab at the end of the day going, like, you know, I'll have a shot and a Creemore beer. I'll have a shot and a beer. Like, we would sing all these really, really dumb songs, like kind of van, tour van type, you know, jokes. Mm-hmm. And then that melody wound up finding its way into the song Paid Back, which is so funny. But that was how Charlie worked too. He'd go like, that's the hook, you know? And then next thing you know, something really, really dumb that we were doing would find its way actually onto the record. And I don't know, it was so awesome. Like, that guy was just magic. Like, he could, I remember working with him in Austin at his home, and we were mixing and tracking vocals, and he did this weird thing where he waved the microphone in front of the mixing speakers, and it just did this weird feedback thing at this one part of the song. And it was an amazing effect, and it's just on the record. And he would do things like that, like just very naturally, physically, you know, be musical, and it would change everything. Like, the same on the song Darling Sea, at the very beginning, you hear this vibraslap, which is a percussion instrument that goes like, and you hear that, and he just went over, like, it wasn't mic'd up or anything. He just knew it was close enough to the mics, and he could hear Gavin counting off the song, and he just walked over to where it was and hit it right on the one. Like, regular people have to, you know, toil over moving things with a computer around to, like, make magic like that happen. And that guy is brilliant. There's just no other way to put it.
Cool. Well, why don't we listen to something beaming off of 2007's Wall of Fire by Peter Elkiss, who's joining us tonight. And then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more, okay?
Standing online for some food today. I must have been a million miles away. And when I finally came back to Earth, I turned around and there you were. And you said, baby, baby, where were you just now? I can tell that something heavy's got you down. But if you let your little darling see, I'm sure it ain't as bad as it seems to be. Yeah, don't you know there's something beaming, something beaming. I know it's out there, baby, I can see it beam. Like the sun, strong enough to light up the horizon. But it seems so far away, seems so far away. Said I must confess, my little world has become quite a mess. While I'm chasing down my little dream, the world around me is busting at the seams. You said, baby, that is not your load to take, 'cause if you do, your little back will rake. I know your world could be a peaceful place if you only open up and see there is a trace. Something beaming, something beaming. I know it's out there, baby, I can see it beaming. Like the sun, strong enough to light up the horizon. But it seems so far away, seems so far away. Yeah, but there's something. I can see it, I can see it, I can see the sun.
That was Something Beaming by Peter Elkis. You're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk. Peter's joining us tonight. So, Peter, we just finished talking about your album Wall of Fire, 2007. Since then, 2011, you released an album called Repeat Offender. People refer to it as an album for fans of Keith Richards, Bill Withers, Ron Sexsmith, and Del Shannon. That's quite the combo. It's a great album, and I think Atlas is my favorite song on that one. And then more recently, you put out an album called Lion. And can you talk a little bit about the production on that and how that came to be?
Yeah, Lion is unfortunately an EP, so it's only six songs, and it was definitely meant to be a full-length record. It's so funny when I'm hearing you like talk about the chronology of everything and the dates, and I'm like, how could there be that much time between things? Like, I think I have a sort of a twisted sense of time. Like, I just can't believe it's been as long as it's been since I started doing my own thing musically and recording with the band and everything. But, you know, I am just not a prolific writer. Like, I feel like it takes me a long time to really say what I want to say with music. I also don't, you know, I don't feel like music's the only way I express myself. So
yeah, I kind of feel like you were touring a lot though, like during those times. And so oftentimes, it's hard to you know, put pen to paper and record when you're on the move, your life was changing. Like I don't think I think of it in gaps. I think of it in summations more, right?
Well, that's an awesome way to look at it. And I appreciate that you look at it that way. Cause that's the best way to look at it. And it's probably true because, you know, I did spend a lot of time also, being a sideman for Joel Plaskett, and had an amazing adventures with him, like internationally, and I love doing support, so you know that was important to me too, to kind of go out and be in his band as well. But anyway, yeah, so like it's funny, like those six songs that wound up on Lion, like they were all real like labors of love. Like each one, you know, was just like carefully written over a long time, and I think I was kind of reticent to like put a record together that would have any toss-offs or any sort of like throwaway feelings. Like I wanted everything to sort of mean something. And I figured, well, if I'm taking this long to put something else out, it's not like anybody's beating my door down to hear something. So let's make it good. And the intention was absolutely to finish it off. And it kind of still is. But now I kind of feel like maybe I've, you know, gotten to a place where I would just start a new record rather than finish that one, which is fine. So, cause those six songs I think work pretty well together, but that was the really like Repeat Offender was sort of de facto self-produced. I was working with my friend Ian McGettigan, who is from Thrush Hermit and Joel Plaskett, and he's one of my old Halifax friends. And the production kind of got derailed when we were doing that, and I ended up kind of having to take over. So I sort of learned how to produce on that record, and of course, like absorbed tons of stuff through osmosis from Charlie Sexton, Don Kerr, who's incredible, who produced Party One, and of course like working with Joel, who's an amazing producer too. So I sort of like figured all that out, and from Ian. So Repeat Offender kind of finished off myself, but Lion was the first thing where I had to fully self-produce. But of course I have like the best band. Like it's such a fraud that I'm called Peter Elkis. Like it's really a band. Like Jeff Haychalt on keyboards, Jeremy Little on bass, and Gavin McGuire on drums, and Doug Friesen, who played with us for years on bass. Those guys are all such a part of it. And so what's fun is that Lion really is a bit of more of a band record too, because everybody had a ton of input. Mm-hmm. And you learn when you're playing with guys that are that good for years that like you just defer to people who are good at what they're doing. Like the same way that they defer to me. Like it's a pretty good cooperative. And Jeremy wound up being like very available and very keen to help. So was really key. So I think on the credits, it says like produced by Peter Elkis with Jeremy Little. It's kind of, you know, it's probably more of like a co-production, but just happens to be my studio and my record and my money. So, so it's like, you may as well, you know, put my name on there as the main producer. But that was like, that was at my, my new home studio, which is in my garage, my home in Toronto. And so we worked all the bugs out with that. And it was just like late nights, way too much tequila, like going late. And that also kind of might have something to do with why it's not a full length record too, because it sort of got, it was a bit drunky some nights, you know? But really fun. Like, I don't know. And it does feel like all those guys go off and do other stuff. Especially Jeff, like he's in so many bands, but it does feel like this group seems to be home base. Cause they go way back, right? Like they were the Bert Nielsen band with Mike Filipovich forever. So I think they feel like a family already, them. And then I'm lucky enough to kind of be a part of it too. Yeah. And so it was like Cinder Bridge is my favorite song off the record. And I worked on it forever. I played the riff, that thing you hear at the beginning of the band, which is like not a complex riff by any means. And I worked on that. I played that over and over and over for like a year easily. I just had it kind of on the guitar and I kept moving it around different keys. Like nobody in their right mind would spend that much time on a riff like that. And I think when we recorded it, we also like, it was too slow for me and everybody else was saying, you're crazy. What are you talking about? And I wound up like getting everybody, it was all already almost finished. And I made everybody come back and track it again to make it a bit faster. Yeah.
What does that term mean, Cinder Bridge?
Cinder Bridge is like the idea of like the expression, a burnt bridge, like you burn a bridge with somebody. The idea is that the bridge is there, exists, it's intact, but it's burnt. So it's like when you like a log in a fire that's burnt to a crisp, but it still looks like a log, but it's just a collection of cinders, you know, and you take a stick and you just can break it apart without any effort. So that song is really about kind of like strained relationships, where, you know, it's really, I guess at its core about kind of passive aggression. And the idea of like maintaining relationships with people where maybe they're sort of, they need to just crumble, you know, and then start over. And that's what that chorus is all about. And then the whole EP, it kind of has those sort of themes of kind of strained relationships and foundations. Like Sturdy Love is like that too. That's about like, you can't build something on a cracked foundation. It's all about that kind of stuff.
Cool. Well, for those just joining us, you're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk out of Hamilton. The show is called Dangerfield. I'm Mary and I'm joined by Peter Elkis, a musician and producer. So Pete, you referenced your home studio. So I guess my question to you is, how do you, how do you kind of treat, like with the studio in your space, how do you kind of allocate your time? Is like, do you kind of move there when you're feeling creative? Are you structured? Like, do you kind of say, you know, there's that whole thing where you have to write, you know, authors say I have to write a page a day, like that kind of thing. Like, what's your time relationship with the creative space?
Well, I'm basically allowed, and I don't mean anybody permits me. I just mean that like I'm a dad, so there's only so much time I can devote to that, and I do other stuff for a living as well. So nighttime is the time I should be out there, but that's the time I want to eat chips. So
what kind of chips? What are your favorite chips?
Probably there's like this chips that's like, it's called Devil's Barbecue, and it's not even like a main chip brand. It's like a, I think it's like Irresistible, which is one of the grocery store brands. Do you know that? Like, I think like it's like one of the Sobeys ones is our Irresistible. Yeah. Is it? I don't think it's our compliments. It's even like a more scrappy one.
Is it a Robert Palmer chip, Simply Irresistible?
It is. I think probably more normal people could resist it just fine, but I find it really good. It's like this really scrappy Devil's Barbecue, and then that with like a Diet Pepsi, and then that will prevent me from going to the studio, no problem. but so, yeah, I try to go at night. I think like I'm trying to reinvent things too so that I can go during the day. And I like the other part of my living is that I do voice acting and I do commercial voiceover work. So I do that at the studio as well. So sometimes I'm in there and I have to do that rather than do music. But it's just been like a chip away kind of process. I've been in my home for 5 years and like, yeah, exactly. Chips away. Super, no pun intended, by the way. That's amazing. And then like, yeah, like I started when we got our home, I was a holdout for like a cinder block structure in the back, like a garage that I could actually, that was solid and not just like a shack or whatever, that I could actually build something in. And I had to be really conscious about cost or whatever. And anyway, now it's like fully running and really good and sounds amazing for the kind of music I want to make. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm actually like, you know, I'm producing other artists now and there, and it's going great. Like I love it. And I wish I could get out there every night. I just find like, I need to be compelled. I've never been good at homework. Like if you said my homework for today was to burp, I would probably procrastinate on that. You know, like I just can't, I need somebody to crack the whip on me. It's just the way I am, but, you know, yeah. And so should I talk about the person I'm working with right now?
Yeah, I was actually going to mention that because there was, so when quarantine happened, there was this incredible video that you put out, which was, I don't even know how you describe it, when it's like, how would you describe that format? Maybe, yeah, you talk, you're better at it.
Well, I think like, you know, I certainly didn't invent anything because like the idea certainly is like pretty ubiquitous. Like people, there are a ton of videos out there that are like it. Yeah. But I think at the time I thought of it kind of on without anybody telling me to do this, but it was just the idea that I would send a track to a friend and I would ask them, film yourself playing the drums to this song. And then they would send it back to me and it would become like a back and forth exchange. And then I would film myself playing another instrument over top their thing, and then build it up and so on and so on until you were left with like a multi, what do you call that, shot, like a collage, a visual collage of the different shots all playing at once to the song. So just basically a collage montage of all the instruments, playing, and a mix of the song. Yeah, so I don't know.
I want to play one that I saw that I thought it was so remarkable, and I remember you posted it on social media, and I shared it immediately, and I believe it was yourself and Danny Nash doing Just the Two of Us, was it not?
Yeah, that's right.
Shining through to make those rainbows and
I see that morning sun, I want to spend some time with you. Just the two of us.
So, like, what you heard there is Danny Nash, who is a drummer, Toronto drummer. She's playing. I sent her like a rough demo of the song, of me playing, just playing keyboards and singing to a metronome, and then she filmed herself playing drums. But she just set up her iPhone and used the microphone from the video app. So it's getting like a very, very raw sounding track. And then I'm importing that audio and making it, you know, trying to sweeten it up and make it better, and then lay it on and lay it on. And then she's doing her background vocals the same way. So a lot of what you hear in there is like the same audio that everybody has on their phone, you know? But I think like you get the kind of neato alchemy of it all, and it sounds kind of cool.
Sounds awesome. And so let's talk a little bit about the work that you're doing now. So you're creatively partnering with Danny right now. Can you talk a little bit about what you're working on and what's to look forward to?
Yeah, dude. So Danny is somebody that everybody who's ever been to the Dakota Tavern would know. She's like, was an institution within the institution, like herself as just like a rocker or bartender. And I think the first time I really ever kind of met her or really talked to her, I walked in and the band The Mercenaries were playing. And they were rocking out on the stage, but somebody else was singing, like, and it was a female singing. And I looked, and there's Danny behind the bar, like, serving beer, but with a headset microphone doing Robert Plant from behind the bar while she's serving. And it was, like, killer, like, truly badass. And I just said, that's so awesome. I just yelled at her. I'm like, you're amazing. And then eventually got to know her a little bit more, and I asked her band to open for Elkis Band at one of our many Dakota residencies. And that was awesome. And then I said to her, I'd love to record you. I probably said to her, I'd like to record you like 50 times until finally one day she asked Gavin and I to be in a band with her for a wedding, like a really short notice pickup band. And this was last summer. And we went and played with her and rehearsed and had a great time. And I remember standing in like the line for the catering and just said to her, like, just come and record at my place. I'm trying to work all the bugs out. Bring some songs that you don't even care about. And just, you know, you could do it for free. And if you like it, let's submit the songs for a grant application. So Factor, like people may not know, Factor is kind of like the federal fund for music arts, right? And so a lot of bands try to get Factor grants to fund their albums. And a lot of the record labels have them too. So Danny said, okay, fine. Like, basically get off my back. I'll come record at your studio. And then we did three songs. And I think she kind of brought, like, I think she had written them all. Each day she came, it was a song she had just written that day. And it was Danny, Gavin, and me. And I did my best and basically flipped her the demos with full production, and she liked them. And then we applied for the grant and we got it. So my proposal to her was like, do the recording with me. And if we get the grant, work with me and let me produce your record, you know, but don't pay me for the whatever. Anyway, that's all just insider baseball. But lo and behold, now we're working together and we are like in the thick of tracking the record because we got the funding, and it's sounding excellent, and it's going to be like a 10 song record. And the first single comes out on October 1st, and it's called West Side. And it's been, outside of making music with my band, it's been the most rewarding music experience I've had, like in terms of everything from writing, recording, playing, just the hang. And mostly it's just she and I. And she's just like the real deal. She's like got full on X factor. She's a true rocker. She's an incredible drummer. Although she got Gavin to play on a bunch of the songs. We did a lot of it at Revolution, and then now we're doing a lot of the finishing touches at my place. And the songs are really like they're true co-writes. She's bringing lyrics and she's really fearless with her lyrics and her playing is amazing. And she's also not afraid to say that she doesn't like something that I'm doing. And the first tune is called West Side, and it's a kind of 90s rocker. It's sort of like a shoegazing kind of thing. And I'm a full on for real 90s rocker. So I was a good person to have produce it. But anyway, I'd love for you to play it. And this will be like the world premiere of this song because it really only officially comes out on October 1st. So here it is, West Side.
Incredible honor. I'm so psyched. Here we go.
Make it a river.
To 101.5 FM The Hawk. That was the world premiere of a song called West Side by Danny Nash. Wonderful, wonderful artist from Toronto. Tonight I'm joined by her co-producer, co-writer, recording guy, Peter Elkis. So Pete, that was, thank you so much. And thank you to Danny for sharing that. That's really special. And I'm a huge fan of hers, and I look forward to more songs. That was awesome.
I can't wait, Mary, for you to hear the rest of the album. It's so good and cool and daring and comfortable at the same time. Like, it's just awesome. I'm in love with it.
And so, Pete, like, when you're creating with other artists, do you draw on kind of influences or people that have inspired you, or do you more kind of refer to your, like, things that you've learned that you know work for you, and so then that's how you apply them to other people? I don't know if that makes sense, but
no, it does. Yeah, and it's definitely all of the above. I think, like, to me, anything I've ever made that was creatively successful, and by that I don't mean like anybody hearing it or whatever, I just mean like something that you're proud of, usually it starts with some sort of, like, even if it's not spoken, like an overt reference point to something else, something that already exists. But then that gets hopefully totally lost along the way, and then you're kind of left with something else. And the reason it would get lost along the way would be because of, you know, the limitations of the equipment you have, the studio you're working in, your own abilities, all of that. So, and that's kind of magical, right? Like, I remember hearing a long time ago that, like, Peter Gabriel said the song Sledgehammer was meant to be like an Otis Redding song. And I like Peter Gabriel and I love Otis Redding. And I thought that was fascinating because I like the song, but I never would ever guess that that should be like an Otis thing. And now when I hear it, I can sort of hear where that would be coming from. But I thought that was so cool, mm-hmm. that he would start there and wind up with his thing, you know? And it's like, so Peter Gabriel, right? That song. So.
And so are you a creative person who kind of knows when to say, okay, this song's done? Or are you someone who kind of like keeps remaking it until someone's just like, Pete, no, it's done, move on. Like what's, like, are you, how do you start something and how do you end it?
Well, hopefully you have a deadline. That would help. Like in this case, we do have a deadline with what we're working on.
No, I just meant in general, like the creative process. I didn't mean this.
Yeah. But I'm serious. Like sometimes you need that like outside force to basically mm-hmm. say like, you're forced to stop now. Cause if you don't have that, then yes, creatively, you might just go back and go back and go back and reinvent. Mm-hmm. So I think I would naturally be the kind of person that would continue to change things. But I know that I should be the kind of person that says, let go now. I think I'm really good at telling someone else to do that. Like, mm-hmm. don't be afraid to just, we got to finish this, let go. Because I think every artist, like every singer who's not like a super gifted vocalist, like, they always think they could do better. Every guitar player thinks they could do a little bit better. Give me another take. And at one point, yeah, it's just like, well, you did it. Like you did your best. This is it. Let it go. There'll be other songs, right?
Yeah, but when you hear when you create a song like for yourself, do you always hear it as that one version, or do you hear it in like, you know, 8 different styles kind of thing?
Oh yeah, for sure. There are some songs where there's the 8 different styles. Like, mm-hmm. you mentioned Atlas.
Yeah.
That I remember playing for you a demo early on that was nothing like what wound up on the record. It was way more just like, I don't even know what it was like. It was like a rock, like a more normal rock song, but it was just more rocking. And then that song still continues to evolve because like we have a new version of that song that's way more like a Hendrix trio kind of thing that we do, like with me, Jer, and Gav. So I don't know. I think maybe that says something about a song, like where maybe the core of it, the soul of it can like exist with many different presentations. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but I like the thing with me is that like, my songs are so few and far between that like, I can't afford to just like whittle away on one tune. I gotta move on. I gotta try to write other stuff. And I think sometimes like it's easier to keep working on something that's already almost done. than it is to go back to square one. Because like the finish line is like way more inviting than square one, you know?
And as your song evolves, maybe in sound, do the lyrics also, or do they, are they static and do they stay the same and the song kind of revolves around them?
In my experience of my own stuff, it's always stayed there. Like it's always been static lyrically, but I am noticing with Dani, which is such an awesome thing about her, is that she is totally willing to kind of pull lyrics out, throw new things in, or go like, we need something in this spot. And then she'll whip something up. And it's never like cynical or tossed off. It's always like meaningful and real and simple and distilled. And I love it. Like I'm totally learning stuff from her, just from her kind of natural way. It's not like, you know, anyway, it's not like she's figured this out over like eons of practice, you know, like she's just naturally that way. So well, anyway, yeah.
It sounds like a great creative partnership because it sounds like you're both getting, you're both inspired and getting a lot out of it, which is, it's a beautiful thing, I think.
Thanks. Yeah. I hope she's getting as much out of it as I am. I always look forward to it. And maybe it's also like, I'm such like a boy zone guy. Like my old band Local Rabbits was like such a boy zone. And then the Elkus band too.
Boy zone? What does that mean?
Oh, just like a dude factory, like just guys, you know, like no women. And that's not on purpose. That's just like, you know, those are the bands I've been in are just guys. And I find like working with Dani, just refreshing. And there's another artist named Claire Whitehead, who's got a single coming out who I produced. And Claire also had like a really different way of working and was very organized about things. And not saying I'm not chalking that up to them being female artists, but it's definitely a different feeling, a different energy, you know?
For sure. So for those just joining us, we're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk out of Hamilton. Tonight, I'm joined by artist Peter Elkus. So Pete, I can't not mention some of the work that you do, your charity work that you do, which is a charity called Light of Day. Can you talk a little bit about who benefits from it and how you also benefit from the experiences that are gained from the work that's involved?
Yeah, Light of Day is a foundation in the U.S. that benefits and raises awareness for Parkinson's research and other kind of similar illnesses. And it's all based on one gentleman named Bob Benjamin, who was diagnosed with Parkinson's back in 2000. And so then a bunch of his friends decided to throw him a birthday party and raise funds for his healthcare. And that evolved like rather rapidly into a week-long festival with multiple shows and raising millions of dollars for Parkinson's, and often features Bruce Springsteen, who shows up and plays. And this all takes place in Asbury Park, New Jersey, kind of Bruce's North Pole to his Santa Claus, his kind of his home stomping grounds. And there is a Canadian chapter as well, the Light of Day Canada. And back in 2011, my friend Andrea Rehill invited me to play one of the events in Hamilton. And so I went and I had like an amazing time and met some of the artists who kind of tour around with it from the States. So that'd be Joe Durso and Stone Caravan, his band, and then Willie Nile, who's like a pretty famous kind of New York punk rocker. He's like an older guy now, but still rocks. And I fell in love with the whole thing and then decided to not only like participate as an artist, but also try to help and organize shows. So I'm not doing that now. But I helped put on all the Hamilton shows kind of after that for the next, 4 or 5 years. And I just went to my kind of Rolodex and got my friends, like, so Sam Roberts and Joel Plaskett and the Trues, guys to come and play. And those guys all came and raised money and did it for free. Sam, like, and the boys just donated their whole thing, not just their music, but their crew, everything. And, you know, asked for nothing in return. And we managed to raise like quite a bit of money for the foundation. And we were really happy about that. And as far as like what I got out of it, I'm a huge fan of Bruce Springsteen, as you know, and got to go and play and be on stage and chat and meet Bruce a bunch of years in a row down in Asbury Park starting in 2011. And those became kind of little annual little adventures that I would have. And they're incredible. Just like, I don't even know where to begin with how amazing those encounters were.
And what's your favorite Springsteen song?
I don't know. It's funny. Like, there are just so many, the eras all do something different to me. Like, I'm still a fan of like the stuff all leading up to Tunnel of Love. And then thereafter, I still consider that new Bruce, even though that's all like 30 years old, you know? So I think to me, like, I can't live without Born to Run, that mm-hmm. record. But then I can't live without The River. And I also can't live without Born in the USA. And then if I hear Greetings from Asbury Park, I'm like, this is the best shit. I don't know. It's like, it's all like deeply important to me. It's so funny. But there's a song from Tunnel of Love called Two Faces. And I was really kind of floored by that for a while. Like the whole thing, like I found it kind of mysterious. Like, and that record's really neat because it's like kind of the love story album, or like, you know, the album that's really overtly about men and women. And I got to ask Bruce about that song, and it was super cool because I was asking him that question in like 2011. And then we're talking about a song from 1989. And it was like, he didn't miss a beat to just kind of right away launch into, well, you know, that song's about this or that. Like, he seems very, very connected to his music. Whereas I have like 1% of the songs that he has in terms of numerical value. And like, I can't even remember my lyrics. And he's like, so just lives in his tunes. But I want to tell you this funny part of one of the trips where I went, and there's a gig they make you do in Asbury Park when you go and you play at Light of Day. Like, if there's the big show at the Paramount Theater in Asbury Park, and that's where Bruce usually shows up, and he'll get up with a band called Joe Grushecki and the House Rockers. And so what happens is that's like a multi-band night, and it's in a big theater, and they close the curtain. And when they close the curtain, they throw somebody out to the dogs to play two songs in front of the curtain with an acoustic guitar for like a chatting huge crowd. And so I've gotten to do that a few times. But so this one year they throw you out, and the summer just before that, Bruce had come to Canada, and he had played, like, I think for the first time ever, played in the Maritimes, and he played in Moncton at Magnetic Hill, which is like a funny landmark.
Yeah.
And I got to go to that show. And anyway, I was standing side stage, and I had chatted with Bruce like really briefly, because the year before was the first time I kind of really met him. And I had the courage this time to kind of, you know, tap him on the shoulder and say, hey, it's Peter from last year. You know, I'm going to be playing a song in front of the curtain, or I'm playing before Willie Nile tonight, you know. And then he said, oh, that's cool. Yeah, look forward to hearing you play. And in my mind, I was like, well, he's not going to, because I'm going to be in front of the curtain. So he'd have to be in the crowd to see me play. So anyway, this thing, like, it's a really old theater with really tight wings. So like, there's a million people all kind of standing side stage. It's hard to move around. And when Bruce is there, it's that much more kind of tense, and the security is heightened and everything. But sometimes you'll see Bruce, like, you know, everyone wants to talk to him, but at the same time, everybody's afraid to approach him. So sometimes he'll be walking around and he doesn't really know who to talk to. Anyway, he sees me standing there, and he's already talked to me. So I'm there with my guitar waiting to go on to do my two songs. And he comes over and he goes, hey, did you go on yet? And I'm like, no, I'm about to go on now, and you got to juice up my guitar for me. And so I don't know where I got the nuts to do that, but I take my guitar off and I hand it to him, and he like gives me this kind of like begrudging sort of like, okay, I'm doing this now. And he takes my guitar and he puts it on, and he's like strumming it kind of gingerly along with the band that's on stage, like just with their music. He's going like E and D, those two chords. And then he kind of rubs it like hard on the side, like a genie bottle, you know, and genie lamp. And then he gives it back to me, and I'm like, I'm blown away, right? Like, that he's just done that. And he has this kind of small chat with me, and I'm reminding him about being at Magnetic Hill in Moncton, and I reminded him that he kept calling it Magnet Hill, which is the wrong name. It's fun to be here at Magnet Hill. And anyway, now it's called Magnet Hill. But so then I go on stage and I do my two songs, and it's really funny too, because my guitar now is like out of tune, like Bruce Springsteen knocked it out of tune. And I'm like, who cares, whatever. And I do my two songs and everybody's talking and it's fine.
Yeah.
And then I come off, but I'm like just already kind of like I'm flabbergasted. And then Jeff Heyshall is with me. So he was allowed there because he was going to play keyboards with Joe Durso's band. So anyway, he comes over to me. He's like, dude. And I'm like, what? And before he can say anything, Bruce Springsteen walks in from the audience. Like he had gone out into the crowd and leaned up against the wall and watched me play. And I'm coming off and he comes up and he goes, hey, you sounded good. Like that. Not like you were awesome or not, like nothing more than you sounded good. But it was definitely the only compliment like or comment I'll ever need to remember, you know?
What, so, you remember the two songs you played?
I played Goodbye to Dublin and I played.
I love that song.
Yeah. And I played, I think I played Fall Apart Again, which I think when I was playing it, I realized was a mistake.
Goodbye, like it wasn't that's perfect.
But Dublin was good. And, you know, I think like, yeah. And so needless to say, I was like all the blood like left my head. You know, that feeling you get when either something amazing is happening or somebody's yelling at you or like, you know, that feeling like it was just like, oh my God, this is not happening. I can't believe it that he just watched me play. And then there was a whole after party and blah, blah. And we had like that night was really more like hanging out with him somewhere and talking to him throughout the night, you know, like standing right beside him. And he was sharing stories with me and showing me pictures on his phone. And we were talking a ton about guitars, like just like two guys nerding out about guitar and music. And, you know, it's like the kind of conversation that you just dream about having with one of your heroes. And I think he knew that he was giving me that, you know, that's what is pretty remarkable when I think back to it.
Yeah.
Like he thought, yeah, like, okay, I'm going to give, you know, this guy's all right. And I'm going to hang out with him for a bit, you know? And it was really, 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 really awesome. Yeah.
Well, on that note, Pete, I want to end on a beautiful note because that's just a blissful ending to this wonderful conversation. So I'd like to thank you for your time. We're at time right now, but that was super fun. And, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me, Mary. And you sound great on the radio. I love it.
On the radio, as Van Martin.
radio. Yeah.
Okay, my dear. Have a great night. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is CIOY 101.5 FM. The Hawk is on the air.